ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge with a really nice history and philosophy of science conversation this week. I love talking philosophically about science because science is one of those fascinating domains that are supposed to exist serenely on a plane of pure objectivity and empiricism. Science is often thought of as something apolitical, resistant to ideology, or good science anyway. And science is supposedly what you're doing when you push away all the cultural stuff and get down to facts. But today we're going to be hearing the story of a moment in 20th century history when politics and culture stormed the ivory tower of good science. And the result was even better science, although that point hasn't necessarily filtered through to broader society yet. It's the story of how second wave feminism in the 1960s and early 1970s came to exert an influence on primatology. That's the study of non-human primates, apes and monkeys and so on. And it's a story that has considerable relevance today, as some of the myths of primatology that feminists were challenging back in the 60s and 70s are still very much with us today. For example, the myth of primate societies being structured around a small group of aggressive alpha males, and of course the related myth that human societies are naturally supposed to be run the same way. Well, here to tell us that story is Samara Greenwood. She's a podcaster whose HPS podcast I can highly recommend. I'll tell you more about that later. And she's also a PhD candidate in the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Melbourne.
Second wave feminism was a social and political movement generally understood to have emerged in the early 1960s. So at the time, it wasn't called second wave feminism. It was generally called the women's movement. And there were two major streams. There was a first early stream that focused primarily on equality. So this was especially about combating sexism and prejudice against women in the workplace. But from about 1967, there was a new, more radical and more intellectual stream that emerged, typically referred to as the Women's Liberation Movement, often known as Women's Lib. This more radical stream focused on challenging the deep assumptions society held at the time about women, in particular, the pervasive mindset that women's natural role in human society was one of support, so a secondary role, whether that was in support of children or of men or whatever. In my research, it's this more cerebral, I guess you could call it, feminism that proves most crucial to the changes that we later see in the scientific field of primatology.
First wave feminism, we're talking about a fight for political equality, you know, suffrage and legal rights and that kind of thing, whereas the second wave, we're looking at equality in social spheres, family, workplace, social relationships. And that's really interesting. So you say this is where the philosophy starts to emerge.
Yes, certainly there's always been a philosophy and theory in feminism, even going back to first wave feminism. But what we see coming through with the more radical second wave feminism, particularly the women's liberation movement, is it becoming almost a bit more psychological. What is it inside of us that holds these assumptions, even, you know, within women ourselves or themselves at the time, that they realise that they were kind of buying into this notion that they're second class citizens? And so first of all, the challenge is to identify that this is a thing, and second of all, to challenge that, to work out how that can be shifted so that there is more equal understanding as well as actual equal treatment out in the world.
So second wave feminism then sees the emergence of a diversity of voices and perspectives within feminism, and one of those voices was that of Donna Haraway, who's actually thought of today as more of a third wave feminist. Maybe we can talk about that in a minute. But her early work is definitely informed by these second wave feminist concerns that you've just been talking about. Your work, in some ways, takes as its starting point a book of Donna Haraway's that was published in 1989, Primate Visions, Gender, Race and Nature in the Modern World. Very interesting book, groundbreaking book. Tell me about that.
Yes, it is. It's a massive book as well. It's very ambitious. In it, Haraway's really looking at a range of ways in which society and shifts in society impacted the scientific study of monkeys and apes throughout the 20th century. And as part of that, the last section in that book, she really looks at feminism and primatology. So she's seen to be the first and probably most famous scholar to write in any significant way about this connection between the rise of second wave feminism on the one hand and later changes in primatology. So as you were saying, she's more considered a third wave feminist, but in this work she's being a historian of science and looking at how second wave feminism that came before affected primatology.
And she looks at four cases of women primatologists in that book who all identified as feminist and produced work that in some ways challenged traditional accounts of primate social life. Tell me about that.
Yes, exactly right. So what she's looking at is particularly how this range of what you would call feminist scientists, they were both feminists and scientists, beginning from around 1970, worked to challenge the standard accounts of primate social life, where typically, and I'm quoting from Donna Haraway here, males were depicted as dominant and females as derivative. So instead, what Haraway shows was how these scientists developed research that clearly showed female primates weren't peripheral when you actually look at the science and you do the proper studies, but rather central active agents in their social groups. And importantly, she made a much stronger claim as well. What she was claiming was that these feminist scientists helped restructure the whole field of possible stories to be explored and told around sex and gender within primatology.
Your work is inspired by Haraway, but there's also a sense in which you're looking to remedy some aspects of her work that you find to be lacking. What is it about Haraway's work that you find comes up short?
Okay, so first I would love to be clear that I do find Haraway's work really brilliant. She has incredible depth of research and her insights are really profound. But it's well recognised generally that her writing style in particular can be challenging. You need to know that Haraway was a leader in postmodern approaches to scholarship during the 1980s, and this approach set out to really upset kind of rigid traditional approaches to research and writing, and they did this through playfulness and inventiveness in language and structure, right? And so when I read it, I actually really enjoy it. I love getting immersed in the style, but it is again well recognised that it's difficult in that kind of approach to make clear connections between specific claims made and then the evidence used to support those claims. So therefore, in my own research, what I decided to do was to take, first of all, a much smaller slice of time. So I look closely at the period of very first contact between feminism and primatology, which takes place from over the period 1970 through 1975, and then take a more traditional kind of thoroughgoing historical philosophical approach. So this means researching who the key players were, their background, their motivations, their connections to feminism, exactly how they were connected to feminism, as well as to each other. So getting a bit of a network understanding of how they influence each other, as well as what their outcomes were, what their feminist-inspired interventions were into the field of primatology, and then the impact of those interventions. So really trying to develop a thorough storyline that develops concrete connections between these things. And I do this not only through reading their published work, but also looking back at archival documents and conducting oral history interviews with the major players, including Donna Haraway herself. So she knows about this project and she's very enthusiastic in the work that I'm doing, which I'm happy to say. So that's where my work fits in, into it, following on from building on top of Donna Haraway's work and also taking a slightly different, more classically historical approach.
Okay, so you've gone back to the early 1970s with this narrower focus to try to do a more detailed historical study. And what you found is a group of women scientists who were taking ideas from the women's movement at the time and applying them to their respective scientific fields. One really interesting one was Sally Slocum, not a primatologist as it happens. Tell me about her.
Yes. So Sally Slocum is an anthropologist, an evolutionary anthropologist who does work in primatology. You need to know at this time that they're very closely related. Not so closely related today, but at this time they very much were. So she's learning about primatology. She's much more invested in the evolutionary anthropology. And what she does with this background is she becomes the first scientist to explicitly use the lessons from the women's liberation movement to critique standard scientific assumptions in a peer-reviewed publication. So notably about Sally Slocum is that she first presented her critique in a really original and striking paper. This is called Woman the Gatherer, Male Bias in Anthropology. And she presented this at a very high-profile academic conference in the year 1970 while she was still a graduate student. So this is a really interesting thing we're seeing at this time where typically, almost across the board, the female scientists that I'm studying that are also feminists are of a particular age. They're generally late 20s, early 30s. They're generally lower in the hierarchy of status in academia, whether they're students, recent postdocs, and they're also very much at the center of where the action is. So, for instance, University of California, Berkeley is a key area, and Sally Slocum was a student there.
And in this Woman the Gatherer, Male Bias in Anthropology paper, she was challenging a theory that was promulgated actually by one of her own professors. And it was a very influential sort of dominant theory in anthropology at the time. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the theory is called Man the Hunter, and it was developed, as you said, by one of her own professors at UC Berkeley, Sherwood Washburn. So in this theory, Washburn's claim was that a whole swathe of complex human traits, so think like cooperative action, complex communication, manual dexterity, tool-building skills, that these only developed in early man, as they would have called it then, these only developed because men began going out to hunt large game, right? And so this is the man the hunter theory. But Slocum points out that this story of human evolution seemed highly implausible, as it implies that only half the species evolved, right? It's very male-centric. Men are mostly the ones going out to hunt big game. And so this is where all of these traits are coming from. This doesn't seem like it's bringing in all the possible evidence, right? Wasn't it far more likely that the other half of the population, who also demonstrated all of these complex traits, were also crucial to their development in time? And of course, what she finds is the answer is yes. So I want to explain a bit more about what she means by yes, it's not just a male story, there's females involved here as well. So what she notes in the paper is that scientists were already aware at this very time that one of the first major events in the developments of human sociality was the increased independence of newly born offspring. So what this means is we've got an increase in brain size during this period. And so human babies are born less developed than other primates. So they're less developed than the monkeys, they're less developed than the apes. And they require substantially greater effort from the whole social group to feed them, to carry them, to educate them. And so this major physiological change then puts strong pressure on the social group to develop exactly those complex traits referred to in the Man the Hunter theory. So higher levels of communication, to educate the young, to coordinate amongst the group, to take care of the young, cooperation, manual dexterity, and even tool design, which Sally Slocum in the paper, agreeing with others who already understanding this at the time, was that the first human tools were much more likely to have been slings to carry young and food, as well as digging and crushing implements to create highly nutritious food, over weapons used for hunting, because this is an activity that only developed, really, we believe, at a much later period. So the upshot of this is that the evolutionary pressure for developing more sophisticated characteristics didn't just come from these new male behaviours that came about with hunting, right? But rather from new behaviours required across a broad gender spectrum and much more developed because young needed more care.
And the key thing here, I guess, is that this challenge to the scientific status quo was directly related to her encounter with ideas coming out of the feminist movement. Who was she influenced by?
Right. So in one of the most fascinating paragraphs that I've ever read in any scientific paper, she actually states in this paper that she would never have thought to criticise such a prominent theory as Man the Hunter, especially, being a junior student at the time, or to, go up and challenge the status quo of science more broadly, until her awareness of social inequity was raised by her engagement with the feminist movement. So this is a general reference she puts in the paper. But then as part of my research, as I mentioned, I interviewed various people and I managed to interview Sally Slocum, who was a bit of a find, as I believe I am the only academic to have ever managed to interview Sally. And she revealed to me that this feminist critique arose after she was persuaded to join a feminist, what we would call a women's liberation consciousness raising group. So these were very common at the time, groups of women coming together, reading material related to consciousness raising, and then reflecting on how it impacted or how they could relate it to their own personal experiences in a way to shift their own thinking. And then once their own thinking was shifted, they could take that out into the broader world and challenge other avenues. And this apparently is exactly what happened for Slocum. She fairly reluctantly attended these groups. It was a friend kind of dragged her along because she was quite shy. But when she was there, the material she was reading, she said it really did. It opened her eyes to things that she'd just taken for granted. In particular, I remember that she mentioned one particular piece called The Politics of Housework. And in this piece, it was all about the assumption that housework was a female domain, and that men, even men who proclaimed they were feminists, still had all of these kind of reasons and excuses not to do the housework. That was for their partner. And this resonated for her because that was exactly what she was experiencing in her own life and in her own marriage. This became a bit of a moment for her. And as a result of that, of talking with other like-minded women, particularly women that were also in science, she realised that this kind of thinking could be applied directly to what she was actually learning at that stage at the university. And so this is what gave her the impetus, the motivation, the enthusiasm, and the tools to then complete this paper.
On Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest, Samara Greenwood, who's a PhD candidate in the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Melbourne. Samara is also a founding producer of the HPS podcast that covers the history, philosophy, and social studies of science. More details about that at the end of the show. Sally Slocum was working in the field of evolutionary anthropology, and we need to talk about how this idea of male bias in the study of human evolution carries across into primatology. And this is where Jane Lancaster enters the story. Tell us about her.
Exactly right. And so, as you said, Sally Slocum, although she's got a background in primatology as well, her critique is very much focused on this anthropology and on evolutionary theory of humans. And so it's when Jane Lancaster comes along. So now Jane is an acquaintance of Sally Slocum's. In fact, their primary connection was their husbands were friends. And like Slocum, Lancaster holds a strong interest in the women's movement, but she was a slightly more senior scientist. So she's finished her doctorate at this stage. She's an early postdoc, and she's working more closely at the centre of primatology during this period. Not long after Sally Slocum presented that paper on male bias in anthropology, she and Lancaster meet and they discuss how that same critique could also be applied to the field of primatology. So this seems even more fundamental because a lot of what evolutionary anthropologists were talking about in terms of human evolution, they were referring back to primatology and theories in primatology as evidence for what they're talking about in the human realm. So if we can apply this critique backwards into the world of primatology, this is an even more fundamental bias, you could argue. So for Lancaster, a very similar form of male bias was clearly evident in one of its own dominating theories, which is commonly referred to as the military model of primate behaviour. In this model, it was claimed that most, if not all, primate societies were held together by the hierarchy and enforcement of a few dominating, highly aggressive males. Now, I think a lot of people know about this theory. You know, there's talk of alpha males and hierarchy of alpha beta males. And this is where it comes from, right? So this is where this sort of popular idea, it did have a basis in science at one point. But let me point out, it is no longer a dominant theory. And so in contrast, still in this model, females, young and other supposedly lesser males were explicitly described in the model as peripheral. So that's the terms used. And they were considered to be much less important to understanding the strength and dynamics of the primate social group. Now, Jane Lancaster was extremely well read across the leading research available at this time. And she understood that this depiction, this very common, very high profile depiction of primate society, was at best incomplete and at worst entirely incorrect. And so to provide a counterpoint, she published a quite wonderful article, it's one I very much enjoy, published in 1973, and it's got the fabulous title, In Praise of the Achieving Female Monkey.
And what is the achieving female monkey achieving, according to Lancaster?
All right. So in this article, she asserts that the studies on which the military model were based suffered, as she put it, from an overemphasis on the behaviour of adult males. And in doing so, by overemphasising that behaviour, theorists were incorrectly assuming that the actions of a small but highly visible minority dictated the actions of the whole. She went on to provide a forceful counter-argument. She highlighted that scientists conducting more balanced studies, and there were, there was not only one type of study being done at this time, it's an explosion of studies in primate field studies. So with scientists going around the world, particularly to Africa and South America, to study a whole range of different primates. And when you look at this range of studies, including perspectives not only of what appear to be the most aggressive males, but also including the behaviour of adult females, young, and what Lancaster termed the less prepossessing males, they were finding a quite different picture of social dynamics. So to illustrate, Lancaster brought attention to a range of findings that were already published that showed the ways in which female primates played a dominant role in their societies. So just as some examples, she discussed how many, if not most, primate societies were not structured around male hierarchies, but rather around female-centric groups. They were the ones that acted as the core glue for a society, and that female primates were not simply support staff to others, but commonly took on leadership roles such as directing group movements, transmitting innovative knowledge between generations, and forming even defensive coalitions against aggressors.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy, I think, to see how male primatologists in the 1960s and early 70s had been looking at primate societies and projecting their own ideas about the naturalness of patriarchal culture onto those primate groups. But was this pure projection, or were there other reasons why the behaviour of male primates attracted more attention? Reasons that had to do with that behaviour rather than the assumptions of male primatologists?
Yes, certainly. And this was very much acknowledged by the female scientists who were talking about this critique. And it is that these were the obvious behaviours. They were large. They were often, when aggression happened, it was in your face. They stood out from the crowd. And so what they realised was required so that you weren't only studying those obvious behaviours, what was required was to be more systematic about how you observed. And so Jean Altman, who is another fabulous feminist scientist I look at and have interviewed, she put out a very famous paper that is now, one of the most cited papers in the world of animal behaviour, about what needed to be done was not just taking ad hoc observations where your attention can just be attracted to whatever your eye catches, but rather be very systematic about making sure you spend equal time on every individual within a social group so that you pick up those subtle behaviours that are harder to tell on first glance and harder to analyse until you've spent that dedicated time. And this helps alleviate that almost observer bias. It's an observer bias where you are attracted by certain behaviours and others that perhaps fade into the background.
Well, you've written that while the work of Sally Slocum and Jane Lancaster and others has been influential, definitely influential within the field of primatology, that influence hasn't necessarily percolated through to the broader public consciousness. Tell me about that. I mean, why do you think that is? And is that important?
Yes. It is one of the sorry, I sounded so sad, didn't I? It is one of the sadder things I've come to realise that although there are these significant shifts occurring around sex and gender and understanding how to study them better and understanding the complexity of their interactions in primate groups and across primate groups, this is happening within the scientific community. And this is not just within the feminist scientists I've talked about. It spreads so that the whole scientific community starts to take on these lessons. You get really rich developments coming through. But that same shift to a more accurate, complex understanding really hasn't yet occurred in the broader public consciousness. I know this personally because I present on this topic quite a bit. And every time I do, I'm asked questions, I have discussions with audience members, and what comes through is that they have never heard about this before. This is not common understanding that this is that this new way, and it's not that new, right? It's 1970s we're talking about, that this different way of thinking about primate societies is being much more variable, much more complex, and that some of these things that we thought were prominent everywhere aren't prominent everywhere, that this isn't in the general consciousness. This isn't in general discussions. And instead, the idea of the aggressive alpha male who rules primate societies through fear and punishment still appears to be very much alive and kicking. And so, yes, I'm saddened because I think, because just me learning about all of this through my research has made me very excited about all the possibilities of it. And it just seems like a fabulous story. And the stories of these women scientists are fabulous. Why hasn't it? I don't know why it hasn't, but I wish it would disperse more into the general understanding.
Well, I mean, there's a backlash, though, isn't there, to that dispersal, even if it were happening? Because I'm masochistic enough to be following a bit of Manosphere content on social media. I don't go as far as Andrew Tate, but I do encounter a fair bit of discourse from blokes who are aggressively male supremacist in their views. And what's interesting is that in that world, you often encounter a lot of ideas about the evolution of human societies and the supposed naturalness of patriarchy. And in a lot of cases, as you say, it's backed up with these same military model ideas from old primatology, you know, the primate societies in their natural state being ruled by alpha males. So not only does the idea persist, but it actually seems to be being reinvigorated and to some extent weaponized by this Manosphere discourse. And I'm wondering, is that just a social media thing, or do you see it being taken up as a challenge to the work of feminist primatologists as it sort of percolated back into the science?
That's a really interesting question. And I must admit, my expertise does sort of limit up to about the end of the 1980s. I try and keep up with a little bit of contemporary primatology, but not so much. As far as I know, within primatology, no, there's really still a very strong line of feminist challenging thinking going on. And so I do know that that tradition begun by Sally Slocum, Jane Lancaster, Jean Altman has continued to today. And I don't know so much about what you were talking about. I haven't entered into the Manosphere at all, funnily enough. But from what you are saying, it does sound like their arguments are really based on very outdated, even blatantly false ideas about primate societies. And so one thing I was thinking is that there is substantial evidence that what you might call a true alpha or leading primate, and now this doesn't have to be gendered, you know, you can just have an alpha individual. In more recent research, typically such an individual would not be overly aggressive, or at least aggressive for no reason, but rather that they have all of these skills in showing respect to individuals of the group. They are very skilled at forming friendships and alliances. They show extreme care for the young of the group. And yes, they do use aggression when necessary, but they're also very good at facilitating making up the group after there's been a fight. So I think a revised view of what an alpha individual is might be really useful, perhaps. I don't know. That's what I can make from that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the time these things come down to the power of narrative rather than the power of empirical evidence. Because if you think of someone like Freud, his reputation as a scientist is highly questionable these days. But we all still talk about the unconscious and the ego and the Oedipus complex. They may not have a lot of scientific merit, but they're demonstrably powerful stories that have embedded themselves deep within our social imaginary. So maybe it's the same with the alpha male concept. Like, all the primatologists in the world could get together and issue a statement saying, no, this idea of dominant alpha males running the show in primate societies is wrong. We have to move on from it. And the narrative of the alpha male would still persist because male humans have too much invested in it. And maybe changing that story is sort of beyond the remit of primatologists.
I think that's an interesting one because more broadly in HPS, we do talk about sticky concepts. So concepts that get the hold of the imagination and people run with them, even exaggerating them, taking them far beyond what they were meant to in science. And then, as you say, when they get debunked in science, they're really hard to dislodge. One thing that does seem to work is to tell a better alternate story, right? So let's start up a story that is based on the science about how primate societies work that is perhaps exciting. I know, as I said myself, when I get into it, I find it very exciting. I think there is a really exciting and interesting story to be told that would be compelling to a general audience. Perhaps we just need some really good storytellers out there to make that happen.
I can imagine a certain kind of listener from whom I will get a cranky email if I don't ask this question. And it's that there's sort of a fundamental objection to the work that you're doing, which is to say that on one hand, we have science, which is a disinterested objective enterprise. And then on the other hand, we have feminism, a socio-political movement that is the opposite of disinterested. And so therefore, that if feminism is having some sort of radical impact on science, then something has gone badly wrong. The science is not good. What's your take on that?
Yeah, look, this is a really big question conducted within history and philosophy of science as well. And what we're coming to more and more is that objectivity in science is complex, right? Complex always comes into it. There's nuance, correct? And the idea is that it's really, really difficult for any individual scientist to be completely objective because we all somewhere, right? We don't have a God's eye view of the world or a view from space. We do kind of. But individually, we are located within certain social conditions. We have certain upbringings. So we are always bringing a particular perspective to what we do as researchers. The answer, therefore, is not to pretend that we're robots and that we have no perspective, but rather to be very self-aware of that perspective, to bring it in potentially when it is useful. Like in these cases, we can see how what the work that by bringing in some feminist ideas about what was wrong in science, about a critique of the science, that in fact that actually bettered the outcome. So allowing those to come in where we believe they're, you know, realistic and helpful, but also having checks and balances by having a diversity of practitioners, by not just having one kind of a scientist from one kind of a background. If we can diversify on race, on sex, on gender, on ethnicity, on class, on nationality, all of these kind of things help us build a richer and more accurate picture than any individual person or individual social group can do alone. And so that's where we talk about subjectivity and objectivity working hand in hand to actually produce a better outcome, a more rational, reasonable, reliable outcome.
Yeah, okay. Well, I take that point. But then if we have old school male primatologists asserting that primate societies are structured around dominant males, and then feminist primatologists come along and assert that primate societies are actually equally structured around females, the non-primatologist could look at those two models and say, well, okay, we have a masculinist take and we have a feminist take on primate societies. Which is the right one? You know, how do we know that the feminist scientists aren't just as influenced by their own ideological priors as the masculinist ones?
Yes, and that's why we have social communities. So, and evidence and lines of research, right? And so building up reliable, trustworthy knowledge isn't a one and done kind of an activity. The process that's involved is social. You have multiple researchers doing work, basing it on evidence as much as they can. And then there's other researchers testing those theories, testing that research, testing its robustness and adding in further ideas. And the idea is through this kind of iterative process, multiple individuals, multiple different projects, using different lines of argumentation, we start to get a convergence, ideally, on one story that seems to hold up with all of these different factors. Now, that doesn't mean that convergence story is the absolute truth and that it can't be changed or improved down the line. But it does give us a sense that there is some trustworthiness involved because it has gone through this series of debate, multiple researchers, multiple lines of investigation with a degree of authenticity, right, and you know, really needed at the base of this. That's how we can start to trust in one version, one theory over another. Which are the ones that have been through this process and still stand on their two feet?
Samara Greenwood. She's a PhD candidate in the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Melbourne. And as I mentioned earlier, Samara is involved with the HPS podcast. And if you're into the History and Philosophy of Science, that is a podcast well worth checking out. We'll put a link to it on the Philosopher's Zone website. And of course, I am contractually obliged to remind you not to neglect this fine podcast and radio show. You can find the Philosopher's Zone online or via ABC Listen. And I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for joining me. and I hope to see you again soon. Bye for now.